Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to the Hour of the Time with your host here, Doyle Shamley in Eager, Arizona. Tonight, 14th of January, 2010. Now, if you'd like to contact the Hour of the Time, you may do so by writing Hour of the Time, P.O. Box 940, Eager, spelled E-A-G-A-R, Arizona 85925. Again, that's Hour of the Time, P.O. Box 940, Eager, Arizona 85925. The website, hourofthetime.com, that's hourofthetime.com. The studio number here in Eager, 928-333-2942. That's 928-333-2942. And the studio number in Canada, 613-733-4324. And if you'd like to email me, you may do so by emailing hourofthetime@hotmail.com, hourofthetime@hotmail.com. Now, ladies and gentlemen, this evening we're going to continue on with our series on the symbolic prophecy of the Great Pyramid, taken from the secret society's own literature. Old books, in fact, and five books are referenced in this series, six actually, but barely in passing and in the first episode. So tonight is the second installment of that series, and I hope everybody is taking notes. Now don't forget, ladies and gentlemen, the Hour of the Time is listener supported. Your support through donations for MP3 broadcasts, DVDs, books, supplies, etc., is how we do the websites, broadcasting, etc. And without that, we can't do it. Speaking engagements, electricity, telephone, all those mundane things that you have to deal with out here. It may seem boring, but the simple fact is that there's all of that support structure to run any operation. So if you're finding the information useful, please donate, ladies and gentlemen. It's a good way for you to support your causes, because that is lacking in the freedom field. Now, another quick reminder about the Pennsylvania conference. We still have space open if you're interested in that. In April in Pennsylvania, meals, lodging, a PDF library of over 3,000 titles, all of that yours, all the classes. We're going to be covering urban type of situations, if you will, kits, food, water, psychology of survival. Also, as a bonus, because we won't have the featured speaker that was in Eager last year, we will be adding some classes that Eager didn't get, and that comes from one of the top graduates, in fact, David Christopher himself, from the School of Natural Healing, Master Herbalist, will be there to teach the Incurables program, the 10 most essential herbs, the top 10 herbs to have at home, in your vehicles, etc., how to prepare them, how to use them, what they're for, etc. So that's a wonderful course in and of itself right there. Also, If you are interested in a Kansas City area conference, shooting in June. We're looking at June or August right now. So a week long, et cetera, lodging, meals, everything included. Email me at hourofthetime@hotmail.com so I can get an idea of how many people might be interested as far as groups, group size, lodging, et cetera. Most of the arrangements are made. All we got to do is put down some final numbers, tell the facilities, and we're ready to rock and roll. So, ladies and gentlemen, again tonight, part two of the symbolic prophecy of the Great Pyramid this evening, the 14th of January, 2010. ladies and gentlemen. Sorry about that long interlude there. Just as I went to musical break, I got a phone call that I've been waiting on. A good friend of Hour of the Times and who helps with all the conferences and everything we do around here. And his wife cooked so much for the events and et cetera. She ended up paralyzed and they had to fly her out to Phoenix. So we've got support from our group, like all of you should be forming groups out there, on their way down to visit, and we're scheduling a course, watching their home, building fires to keep the pipes from freezing, feed animals, etc. That's what we do, ladies and gentlemen, like what you should be doing where you live. But anyway, I had to take that call because I didn't know what facility she was in or room numbers anyway, and we've already got people that have made it down there wanting to visit and check in. So, sorry about the long musical break. We're going to continue on this evening, ladies and gentlemen. Now, some of you took us up on the offer for authentic plates out of the very manuscripts written generations ago. It's an old, old book that is the main reference out of the six for this series, and you were smart to hit me up for that. That offer is no longer available. I told you to email me that night, so don't bother tonight. You need to start listening to what I say. Anyway, it was all the plates and diagrams that you'll wish you had if you didn't get them later on in this series. In fact, admitted in their books, the diagrams are from the mystery schools themselves, not available via historians, etc. Typical college historians. So, ladies and gentlemen, we'll continue on. Some of the earlier and later pyramids built in Egypt as tombs or historical monuments by various kings, queens, potentates were not finished smoothly on the outside, but were left in the form of steps. These are called the step pyramids. None of the pyramids built as monuments was a family monument, but each belonged, as do all Egyptian tombs, to one person, or was constructed to the memory of one person. You see, ladies and gentlemen, it was, believed that by building a monument in the form of a pyramid, the sandstorms would not have the same destroying action upon the slanting surfaces that they would have upon a building formed in the shape of a cube or an oblong. This would indicate that at the time of the building of the first pyramids as tombs, the earlier structures or tombs in Egypt had been built so many centuries before that the sandstorms had already demonstrated their power to destroy them. In many cases, a courtyard or sunken plaza was constructed around the pyramid with a depression of 10 to 20 feet below the surface of the surrounding district, and with a wall around the plaza of sufficient height to keep the sand from blowing into the plaza and filling it. There are sections of ruined walls and evidence to show that the Great Pyramid was surrounded at one time by such a plaza. When one views the Great Pyramid from an airplane flying high above, the broken sections of this ancient wall around the plaza reveal themselves through the shadows in the sun in a straight line, giving a very excellent idea of the large size of the square around the pyramid. The square around the pyramid. Among the mystics or members of the mystery schools of Egypt, the traditions always explain that the Great Pyramid was great in more ways than one. Despite the fact that no entrance was ever forced into the Great Pyramid, nor the inside of it ever seen in more modern times until the year 820 AD, the secret schools of Egypt insisted that the interior of it was well known to them, and that it was not a tomb of any great king, nor a burial chamber of any kind, except that it did have one chamber for symbolical burial as part of an ancient initiation ritual. Ladies and gentlemen, I hope you're listening. The mystery schools of Egypt, the secret schools of Egypt, insisted that the interior of it was well known to them, and that it was not a tomb of any great king, nor a burial chamber of any kind, except that it did have one chamber for symbolical burial as part of an ancient initiation ritual. According to these mystical traditions, at which many of the ancient investigators and historians scoffed and ridiculed, there were underground passageways by which the interior of the pyramid could be entered gradually and in various stages of initiation, with each different mystical chamber at the end of each stage of initiatory progress. And that the highest and ultimate stage of initiation was represented by the king's chamber, which, by the way, was given an entirely different name in the ancient ritual. Little by little, some of these traditional statements were verified as, for instance, when it was discovered that there was some connection between the Sphinx and the Great Pyramid, and that there was a connection between the Sphinx and an ancient underground temple located near the Sphinx. Then was discovered a secret court or open temple before the paws and breast of the Sphinx. But since most of these were still buried beneath deep sand, the facts could not be proved or readily demonstrated. Throughout all of the ages, there has been a determined effort, ladies and gentlemen, on the part of the knowing ones in Egypt to deny to the general public that there were any chambers or passageways within the Great Pyramid, or that there was any proper and architecturally designed entranceway to the Great Pyramid. It becomes apparent as one studies and analyzes the carefully worded denial of these chambers and passageways, as found in the writings of early investigators and historians, and is repeated even today by many of the Egyptians, that there was some sort of ancient curse placed upon those who would reveal to the profane or the uninitiated the existence of these chambers and passageways, or the fact that the Great Pyramid was a temple of mystical initiation and ceremony. It is amusing to find that even today, visitors who are deemed worthy and secure the necessary passes after the proper identification and are allowed to enter the pyramid and visit some of its passageways, even the so-called King's Chamber, and warned as they leave the pyramid to say nothing of their entrance into the pyramid, and are significantly told, "You see, there is no entrance to the pyramid and there is nothing within it." Thus, the farce, or traditional injunction, is maintained to a certain degree. And one will meet tourists in Europe returning from Egypt who will seriously, and without considerable nervousness, explain that they know there is no passageway to the pyramid and nothing to be seen within it. It does not dawn upon these persons that only one who has been within the pyramid could possibly affirm with positiveness that there were no passageways within it. That the passageways and chambers have been desecrated in the past is self-evident to one who spends time within the pyramids with searchlights and cameras and records carefully every inch of the walls of both passageways and rooms. One is reminded of the ancient proverb, "Fools' names, like fools' faces, are always seen in public places." For there is hardly a square inch of this magnificent walls of the great king's chamber that is not injured or mutilated by the carved names, initials, and dates of persons who have visited there, and the same is true of many of the passageways. Fortunately, many of the very beautiful and symbolical pieces of equipment that once stood in these chambers and passageways have been removed to secret museums and hiding places where only the initiated may see them. Ladies and gentlemen, your host here, Doyle Shamley, on the hour of the time, 14th January 2010, with part two of the symbolic prophecy of the Great Pyramid. The website, hourofthetime.com, the studio number 928-333-2942, and eager 613-733-4324 in the Canadian studios. And my personal email address, hourofthetime@hotmail.com. Fortunately, many of the very beautiful and symbolical pieces of equipment that once stood in these chambers and passageways have been removed to secret museums and hiding places where only the initiated may see them. Undoubtedly, if tourists could have had their way, the Great Pyramid today would be scattered throughout the civilized world in little bits cut off and carried away by the souvenir hunters who one meets everywhere and who are so easily satisfied by the commercial artisans who continually manufacture and sell pieces of the original cross of crucifixion, the tomb of Jesus, and the alabaster jars of King Tut. Perhaps we should not attempt to visit the interior of the pyramid on the day of our first inspection of it, for we may become easily tired by giving sufficient time to the outside. Before leaving its environment, however, to return home by camel and then by automobile or trolley car, we will note that the huge stones composing the walls of the pyramid are higher than our own height, and that to climb them must be quite gymnastic. However, little Egyptian urchins challenge us and tell us that for bakshish, which means coin, they will climb the steep outside of the pyramid and reach its towering top in 7 minutes. Knowing from long experience just which crevices to use in getting a foothold and a finger hold, we find these youngsters scaling the side of the pyramid rapidly. Upon their return, they offer for $1 American money to take us to the top that we might have the great distinction and honor of being one American who has scaled the pyramid. Being flattered at this possible distinction, we begin to climb. By the time we have reached the center of the side of the pyramids, we feel we have gone higher than we have ever seen any structure in the world, and this encourages us to go on to the top, which we see is partially flattened by the absence of the original epic stone. Our guide tells us that when and if we reach the top, we may sit there and rest for a while and have a magnificent view of Egypt. Why we ponder over our unique achievement or the rare distinction that will be ours. Continuing our climb from the hanging position in which we rested for a moment, we eventually reach the top and are surprised to find a richly robed Arab awaiting us and reaching over to give us a final help with an extended hand. Just as we are about to indulge in a moment's admiration of our personal endurance and prowess and think of the distinctions we have brought to our race by this unusual achievement, we discover that there is a table placed upon this huge platform of the pyramid with chairs and all of the equipment for serving tea, and that we are but one of the many who daily reach the top and are looked upon with the same casual interest as the passerby who drops into one of the little coffee shops for a cup of black coffee. We welcome the opportunity to rest and view the country which, because of the clear atmosphere referred to previously, may be seen for many, many miles, and finally make our descent with a degree of rapidity which compares favorably with the rapidity with which we lost all of our esteem and pride in attaining the top. Nevertheless, as we wend our way toward the hotel in the heart of the busy city, which looks much like Paris or other great metropolitan cities of Europe, we realize that there is still so much mystery about the pyramid that it will be worthy of all the time and thought we give to it. Now, ladies and gentlemen, the plates will start coming in handy for those of you who took notice and heeded my words and requested them, starting in these next few pages. The location and geographical significance of the Great Pyramid, as well as its unusual size, which distinguishes it from all the other pyramids of Egypt, very definitely refutes all of the arguments to the effect that the Great Pyramid was built as a tomb for a very, very ambitious and vain pharaoh. It is true that a very vain pharaoh might have conceived of building a larger pyramid than any of the others merely to aggrandize his reputation in the future. And it is possibly true that he would have selected an unusual site for it far from any of the other tombs or pharaohs and his royal consorts and relatives. But there are so many things surrounding the Great Pyramid that distinguish it from all other pyramids, and which were wholly unnecessary if it had been intended as an elaborate monument to the record of an egotistical ruler, that one is forced to examine more carefully all of the historical references to this monumental structure. Turning to some of the oldest records available, ladies and gentlemen, the so-called, as he puts it, holy scriptures or spiritual writings of the past, we find the Great Pyramid unquestionably referred to by Isaiah. In Isaiah 19:19-20, we find, "In that day there shall be an altar to the Lord in the midst of the land of Egypt, and a pillar at the border thereof to the Lord. And it shall be for a sign and for a witness unto the Lord of the host in the land of Egypt." Ladies and gentlemen, in Jeremiah chapter 32:18-20, we have another reference, which in the light of time can refer only to the Great Pyramid, including the following words, "which hath set signs and wonders in the land of Egypt." ladies and gentlemen, Holy Toledo Bandito, the phone again. The oldest of the writings of the ancients referred to the Great Pyramid as the Pillar of Enoch. Turning to the Bible, we find references to Enoch talking with God, and we find that Enoch's life is given as having covered 365 years. This being symbolical of the number of days of the year is typical of other references to a year of years, which was called by the ancients the Phoenix Cycle. The Phoenix Cycle. The word Phoenix is the Greek term for the Egyptian word Pa-Henoch, which means the house of Enoch. In this wise, and through other similar references, we find the Phoenicians identified as the descendants of Enoch, and this gives us the explanation as why the Great Pyramid was called by the ancients the Pillar of Enoch, having been built by the Phoenicians, who were the descendants of Enoch. Josephus, the ancient Jewish historian, wrote in his famous records a reference to the pyramid and its significance, in which he states that the ancient people planned to build, and actually did build, two great pillars, one in brick and one in stone, upon which the ancients inscribed their discoveries and marvelous knowledge that it might be preserved for the future. Josephus concludes this reference with these words, "Now this pillar of stone remains in the land of Syria until this day." It is on this point we find that the great Coptic writer Masudi, whose manuscript is preserved in Oxford, stating that the Great Pyramid contains the wisdom and acquirements in the different arts and sciences, the science of arithmetic and geometry, that they might remain as records of those who could afterwards comprehend them. You see, ladies and gentlemen, he explains that the Great Pyramid contains the knowledge of the stars and their cycles, along with the history and chronicle of past times and predictions of things to come. He makes it perfectly plain that even in his day, the old records which he saw and examined referred to the pyramid as a monument that had been carefully planned and so constructed that in its measurements, in its location, and in all of its interior and exterior symbolism, it would represent certain fundamental laws of nature, as well as preserve in its inscriptions an outline of the great knowledge which the ancients had achieved. Now, ladies and gentlemen, why don't we look at its location? The pyramid allegory is referred to in the sacred texts and writings of Egypt. Many of you will be familiar with it, the Book of the Dead. In those texts, the Great Pyramid is called the Temple of Amun. Which means the secret house of the Hidden One. Do not let us overlook the fact that in the New Testament of the Christian Bible, Jesus is referred to as the Great Amun. Amen. Other allegorical terms used to describe the Great Pyramid in the Book of the Dead are the House of the Hidden Places and the House of Light. In considering the fulfillment of the ancient prophecies regarding an altar to be built in the center of the land to remain eternally as a witness to the Lord, we must keep in mind the fact that the size of the world, or at least of the land surface or populated surface of the earth at the time these ancient writings were inscribed was limited in the minds of even the most advanced of the philosophers and thinkers. It is difficult for us of modern times to think of the side of the pyramid as being the center of any great territory of population, except when we stop to consider and realize that the western end of the Mediterranean, where it connects with the Atlantic Ocean, was the edge of the earth to the ancients, and that the only known populated areas of the earth were those which centered around the Mediterranean Sea. And when we realize, too, that Egypt was, in one period of her history, the most highly cultured and civilized nation of the small, limited area, we can understand why a district near Cairo might have been selected as the center of the earth in the minds of the ancient peoples. But, ladies and gentlemen, the truth of the matter is that the truly learned ones of Egypt, those who were members of the illuminated mystery schools and who sought to preserve their accumulated wisdom for the future, were far more advanced in their knowledge of the earth and its size and habitable areas and of the starry heavens and the planets than were the mass of the populace. Even our present-day science of astronomy owes its early foundation to the advanced and extraordinary knowledge which these early mystery schools possessed. There are very definite records in the early references to astrology, the forerunner of astronomy, that these ancient mystical students and scientists knew of a majority of the planets now known to us, and of the stars, despite the fact that they did not have anything like our modern telescope. They gave to those planets names which were retained to this day, and they made references to their orbits and transits and the eclipses and other astronomical phenomena, which definitely proved to us that the mystical philosophers and scientists were fairly well acquainted with the universe in which they lived, as well as with the size and nature of the earth. One of the very definite and startling facts, ladies and gentlemen, about the location of the Great Pyramid is that it is not only in the center of the great land of Egypt, and very nearly in the center of the most habitable portions of the ancient world known to the populace, but it is in the center of the land surface of the earth as it now exists and must have existed at the time the pyramid was built. In other words, if we take a map of the earth as it exists today and spread it out on a flat surface and draw lines upon it which are in accordance with the land surface areas, we shall find that these cross lines indicate the center of the land surface of the earth as being precisely where the Great Pyramid is built. And there is just one other point that may be offered at this moment in support of the argument that the Great Pyramid was erected by those who were familiar with the universe and the great astronomical and geometrical facts. The intersecting point is the fact that the great polar star of the heavens was known to these designers and builders of the pyramid. For many of the mathematical and philosophical inscriptions pertaining to the prophecies of the future are based upon the position of this pole star. Even in regard to the sun and its daily movement, the Great Pyramid is so located as to have a definite relationship with the sun and its movement. And there are other mechanical relationships to the cosmic, as well as the size of the earth, its surface, curvature, and distribution of land and water. Certainly, ladies and gentlemen, all these symbolical references to the pyramid, that it was built as an altar to the Lord and a pillar at the border of the land of Egypt, and to the signs and testimonies which it would contain when built, as well as the fulfillment of these prophecies in the pyramid itself, proved to the unbiased investigator that this great structure was never intended to be a mere monument to the vanity of a pharaoh, nor a glorified tomb for the mortal remains of a king. Yet, there are writers and investigators of the subject who still maintain that the Great Pyramid was built solely as an extravagant sepulcher and a shallow, empty testimonial of the vanity and egotism of an insignificant, unremembered individual. Ladies and gentlemen, as we ponder these very early descriptions of a magnificent altar to the Lord that was to be built in the midst of the land of Egypt, and then find the evidence that it is so significantly situated and surrounded with so many revealing principles, the real mystery of the pyramid deepens, and we become determined to investigate the structure itself. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, your host here, Doyle Shamley, with the Hour of the Time. Ladies and gentlemen, the scientific and especially the engineering world of modern times is just as greatly mystified as is the populace of all the civilized countries as to the methods that were used to build this enormous monument of stone. Especially in the location where it has stood for so many centuries. As one stands at the base of the Great Pyramid and looks out over the surrounding territory, or as one stands upon its flattened top, and looks into space for many miles in every direction, noting all the surrounding desert space and absence of great hills, one wonders first of all where the stone came from which was used in building it. Having climbed up its side and to reach the top of it, there is left in mind the definite impression of the enormous size of the stones which were used. Most of them, being greater in height than our own bodies and seemingly twice as long as they are high, the weight of these stones would seem to be beyond human manipulation. We can recall all of the fanciful stories we have heard of a great contractor with thousands upon thousands of Egyptian slaves pulling on enormous ropes and cable to drag these monumental stones from somewhere into position at the pyramid. And we can recall how these slaves suffered under the lashing of the whip and at the hands of the contractor and builder, and how they toiled for years in building the pyramid. But every contractor and every individual who has ever dealt with human labor under any condition, and especially while it was working under the lashing of a whip, knows that there is a limit to the number of human beings that may be attached to ropes or cables, and to the concentrated and efficient power that may be derived from such individuals. There is a point in the scheme of things, ladies and gentlemen, where a large number of individuals struggling in this manner becomes an interference, much like government, and where efficiency is lessened by the increase of the number. Not only is their ability limited to the exertion of the power, but the space they occupy, the necessary ropes to be attached, and the manipulation of the work causes a situation in which no real results can be obtained. We might just as well imagine the building of a great wall that was to be composed of 100,000 bricks in one section, and to save time and build the wall quickly, we would secure 100,000 men, each to place his one brick in the proper position at the same moment, thus completing the section of wall in 1 or 2 minutes. Even in our modern methods of constructing our homes or office buildings, there is a point in the employment of men where an increase in the number of workers becomes an interference and slows up the progress rather than helps. In our present century, modern contractors and engineers have found it difficult to lift to the top of great arches the keystones to complete the arches. When such keystones represented in weight and size but a corner of one of the great stones of the pyramid. Yet today, we have enormous mechanical derricks and motive power which the Egyptians did not have. A casual inquiry reveals to us the nearest point where the enormous stones could have been quarried was many, many miles away from the present site of the pyramid. They could not have floated them upon rafts down the Nile River, for no raft could have supported the weight of the stones. We recall the problem that faced marine engineers in 1879 when one of the obelisks from Heliopolis was to be moved from Egypt to New York. No ship could be found that would carry it safely, and the first attempt to float it upon a huge raft pulled by a powerful steamship proved a failure. To have dragged these enormous stones over the sands of Egypt from quarries hundreds of miles distant at Thebes seems like an engineering impossibility to the modern mind. Yet, these stones were brought from somewhere and lifted into place. We know from an examination of the interior as well as the exterior of the pyramid that thousands of skilled mechanics, artists, and artisans were employed in the planning, construction, and completion of it. Not all at one time, but over the course of a long period of time. It is doubtful that the pyramid could have been planned so carefully, the stones and other materials so carefully and critically prepared, the construction work carried out with such precision, and the interior decorating done with such devotion and under such expert guidance as was necessary to make every mark and every line and every bit of color have its scientific significance, and the entire structure completed in the lifetime of any one pharaoh. This, in itself, argues against the contention that a pharaoh during the height of his regime ordered the pyramid to be built as his tomb, so that it might be completed before his death and be ready for his burial. It was quite customary for the pharaohs to make sure that the final resting places of their mummies would be adequate in splendor and in the protection they would afford against robbers, thieves, and the curious, in order that their minds might rest easily in this important regard. They saw to it that proper tombs beneath or above the ground were constructed and completed as soon as possible, so that there would be no possibility of transition coming upon them before a place of guaranteed protection and glory was completed. Not one of them would have allowed the plan of a tomb, which would have required many years to design, many more years to prepare for in the cutting of stones and the making of elaborate mechanical arrangements, and a score or more years for decorating and completing, for they would have known that the completion would have passed way beyond their lifetime, and there would have been the possibility of a future pharaoh occupying the place instead. Because of the mystery of its construction, and especially because of the significance and prophecies that are associated with each measurement, each passageway, each chamber, and each little incident of its design and completion, we shall look, ladies and gentlemen, into this matter more thoroughly. You see, ladies and gentlemen, since the Great Pyramid was to be a monument of wisdom and prophecy and contain in some permanent form the outstanding incidents of the past, present, and future history of the world, the problem of putting that information to such language, signs, hieroglyphs, or symbols that all future races of men could decipher and interpret must have been one of the most serious of all the considerations surrounding the construction of the pyramid. We are reminded of the problems which confronted these ancients when they decided to leave a key for future generations to decipher their hieroglyphic language. The Egyptians rightly concluded that the time would come in the distant future when the carved writings and hieroglyphs, as well as all the symbols and signs of their language and of their knowledge, might remain but a knowledge of the meaning of these strange marks and be lost, and therefore future generations might look upon the mysterious carvings and engravings on stone and metal and understand nothing of the great wisdom hidden thereof. The methods, ladies and gentlemen, used by man throughout the civilizations to convey his thoughts, including the spoken language and the written languages, have changed from century to century until today explorers often come face to face with unknown, forgotten, and lost languages. And they are unable to decipher much that would be of great value. There are carvings and writings upon the stones of the mountainsides in Oregon, situated in the west coast of the United States, in the Klamath section, which by their very nature indicate that they were carefully placed there with some important motive and intended for permanency and the revelation of great wisdom at some distant time. As to when these writings were carved in the stone, and what the carefully executed hieroglyphs mean, no authority has yet ventured to state, and research has led to no clue. Undoubtedly, these writings were carved in prehistoric times by a race of people that antedates any of the known races that occupied the United States preceding the American Indians. Because of the similarity of these writings to those in other places in and around the Pacific Ocean, it is naturally assumed that they were made by the descendants of the Lemurians. But if so, it was a special form of writing not commonly used by the Lemurians and probably chosen to be a classically written language of some kind that might be interpreted in the future. In the case of the Rosetta Stone, the desire was to prevent the hieroglyphic language, ladies and gentlemen, of the Egyptians from becoming permanently lost and thus making it impossible for future generations of mankind to interpret all of the sacred writings to be found in the temples and upon the walls and obelisk and other permanent structures of that country. In fact, the hieroglyphic language of the Egyptians was a dead and unknown language until the Rosetta Stone was discovered with a carefully planned key. Ladies and gentlemen, that's where we'll wrap up tonight's segment of the symbolic prophecy of the Great Pyramid. Your host here, Doyle Shamley, in Eager, Arizona. 14th January 2010. I hope all of you took the studious notes and took note of the fact of the allusions to symbols and groups and items and use that to expand your research base with the other audio series that we've done, like Mystery Babylon 1, 2, and 3, The Lost Light, etc. Again, the website, hourofthetime.com. The studio number in Eager is 928-333-2942. The studio in Canada, 613-733-4324. My personal email address, hourofthetime@hotmail.com. Now, I hope everyone has a safe and a studious evening, and be sure to tune in to the Hour of the Time regularly on the website, hourofthetime.com, for research, news, and health.